welcome to the Yes to Life show. My name's Robin Daly, and in the show I talk to key people in the movement towards integrative medicine, a sophisticated synthesis of conventional and complementary medicine. Supporting access to integrative medicine has been the work of the charity Yes to Life for more than a decade. Many listeners were inspired to hear oncologist Ailsa White on a recent show extolling the benefits of lifestyle medicine and in particular nutritional science for health generally, but notably for people with cancer. In today's show, I'm talking to another medical pioneer whose ambition it is to introduce nutritional science into GP medical training. Rupi Orjila is a GP himself, and I met him in a very lively cafe in South Kensington. So you might want to get up close to your player so as not to miss any of this great interview. Hi Rupi, brilliant to have you on the show today. Thanks very much for coming on.
Anytime.
Now, you're a GP, not an oncologist, so I'm not going to be expecting you to be an oncologist. So, but nonetheless, the listeners may be wondering why I'm talking to you on a show that's all about cancer. Well, first time I met you, you told me that you've got this ambition to get nutrition into doctor's training. I thought, this is my man. I want to talk to this guy. And that was enough, really, basically, to make me want to talk to you. So why are you so passionate about nutrition?
It's a really good question. I get asked that a lot, actually, what actually kind of fueled my interest in nutrition. And I think it was a number of things. When I was young, I witnessed my mum pretty much overhaul her medical problems using nutrition. I was only 11 or 12 at the time, and looking back at it, essentially what she did, without going into too much detail, she essentially put herself on an elimination diet for about a year and reversed her problems that had been plaguing her and had baffled multiple physicians at the time. She'd been seeing professors, she's had multiple tests, she was on medications, and nothing was really working for her. So she pretty much took things into her own hand, using nutrition and lifestyle measures. So that kind of experience made me want to go to medical school and learn a bit more about medicine. And I kind of forgot the reason why I went to medicine in the first place until I got ill myself. So when I finished med school, I obviously went straight to junior doctor training. It's a very stressful sort of environment to be in. And I started getting palpitations. I remember vividly I was on call during the day, and I basically went into atrial fibrillation, which is a fast arrhythmia where your heart beats irregularly and very, very rapidly and inefficiently. Yeah, it was quite scary. And I would have these episodes a couple of times a week. And I went through the same sort of barrage of tests and everything. Like, it wasn't the same medical problems with my mum, but I went through that whole pattern of trying to figure out what was going on. I went through all the conventional medicine means, and it wasn't until I came to that point in my own life that I started using lifestyle nutrition myself. And by incorporating good habits and changing my diet up, I overcome those problems. So what it kind of reaffirmed for me, like when I look back on it, there's no particular intervention or thing that I can pinpoint that actually reversed my own condition. But when you put your body into a healing environment, that's when you realise the magnitude of what your own body can do, what our systems are designed to do.
We have
these intricate processes that rely very heavily on nutrition, and I think that concept isn't really taught that very well at med school. And since then, you know, that I've developed my own understanding, I've done literature reviews, I attend conferences, I meet people like yourself. I'm interested in functional medicine and all that kind of stuff. So it's sort of been a journey for me. But yeah, a number of things. And plus, I'm Indian as well. My background is steeped in Ayurvedic medicine and tradition and all those sorts of worldly ancient concepts that are kind of filtered in to my upbringing. And I never really appreciated the complexity or the wisdom actually behind it until the scientific studies to back them up. And now we see, you know, ginger oils and polyphenols and turmeric, for example, as a massive thing. And the whole gut health trend, that's all got scientific backing now. So it's a very interesting time to be in the nutrition world.
It is, it is. So to the man in the street, the concept that good food makes you healthy, it's not exactly controversial, you know, it's sort of obvious with the back cover it, you know. But I think it'd be fair to say that for the medical profession, and notably, unfortunately, oncologists are epically resistant to the idea, and they persist in the notion that not only, well, that the only way to make people well is by administering man-made toxins. So, you know, how do we get in this situation?
Well, I think primarily from my own situation, look at myself, my own experience, nutrition really isn't taught very well at medical school, and that's something that I'm trying to change at the moment. So getting back to basics and actually just having open, honest discussions about what is a healthy diet with medical students from the start is something we need to focus on. Because even today, like there's a very popular update course that GPs go on. And we basically go through all the nice guidelines for common ailments that we see. You get a big booklet about the things that we should be doing and updated, you know, all the different medications that have come out, the evidence-based
bias. Like CPD, continuous professional development.
And, you know, when you look at the nice guidelines, the first thing for many lifestyle-related diseases like hypertension, cardiovascular, etc., is diet and lifestyle advice. When you go to these courses where they teach the guidelines, they brush over that first step because it's kind of the expectation that everyone knows what a healthy diet is.
Right.
Oh, we all know what that is. You know, Mediterranean
diet,
low fat, low calorie.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, there is a complete universe of science in itself in that very, very first step that we brush over. And it's about going back to basics, because if we look at chronic disease, the prevalence is increasing, the morbidity is increasing. People are really unhappy, and people are not getting better on the medication that we offer. Mm. So that's something that I think we need to. But you know what? It is a very interesting time for medicine and nutrition, because medical students who are social media savvy, who are much more in touch with the general public, are getting interested in this field. So I was at a medical school event yesterday, actually, at UCL, and medical students are literally asking me for advice where to get this nutrition information, because they're not getting it taught still at medical school. So,
at least they're aware they're not getting it.
Exactly, yeah, the awareness is cool. Because I wasn't aware. I just thought, nutrition is not something that we need to deal with.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that thing about that, you know, there being a whole world of knowledge and advice there, because I mean, you know, functional medicine at this point is like such a rounded full science, isn't it? It's amazing the amount in there. You know, I've been to any number of nutrition lectures, and at this point I'm down to about 1 in 10 words that make some impression. The rest of it is like, oh my god, this is complex. Don't try and self-medicate. Very complex stuff. But very sophisticated.
Very, very sophisticated. Yeah. And that, you know what? That sophistication, that level of complexity, is something that really excited me. As someone who's interested in science, you know, that's what we should be focusing on. It's not this weird, wacky, alternative world that we've been led to believe. It's actually a very, very interesting field of research.
Great. Okay, so nutrition's one of the key strands of what is called lifestyle medicine, an approach that's succeeding in doing things like curing type 2 diabetes, to give just one example of what it can do. You contrast this with the medication where you start off with one drug for type 2 diabetes, 10 years later you've got 10. You know, things are not getting better, they're actually getting worse. So, you know, choosing which route to go, whether to have a cure that's actually non-toxic or just go down a path of getting sicker and sicker, you'd think was a no-brainer, but unfortunately it's still... It's not clear that choice, even though the evidence is all out there that this can happen. What do you think needs to change?
I think it's a multitude of things. So again, going back to the argument about nutrition in medical school and nutrition for doctors, that's one element. I think patient expectation needs to change as well, because right now what we have is a system where you have less than 10 minutes to see a GP, and the expectation from the patient is that you get a quick cure. You go see the GP, they're going to sort you out.
Right.
But, you know, to incorporate lifestyle medicine or functional medicine, or, you know, those concepts at least, takes a huge amount of time. And it's that time intensivity that leads a lot of my colleagues to believe it's not feasible in the NHS. And to be honest, I hasten to agree with them to an extent. I think we can instigate certain things, and I certainly do within the NHS still, but overall we really need to think about the bigger picture. When we have this sort of model of healthcare that we do right now, it's really, really hard to motivate patients and to make them see that, you know, pills are not the answer. And so I really think it is education of patients to understand that life science. And you know what, there's always going to have to be a place for medication, because some people are just not willing. And unfortunately, that's the large majority of patients right now. Because they've been led to believe through years and years of you know, educational media or just expectation for the doctor to be able to fix things with a pill. And we have this wonderful science that's ever more refined and accurate and precise that can, you know, rid us of any ill. There's always, you know, around the corner from another discovery or another breakthrough. Well, it's just not the case. We need to close the loop by going backwards as well as forwards.
So there's two possibilities, if you like. One of them is that doctors get wised up about nutrition sufficiently to actually be able to prescribe lifestyle interventions. Another one is that actually they realise the importance of nutrition and they get somebody along who already knows, because there's plenty of those out there.
Yeah, totally.
So that would be kind of the quick fix, if you like, and it would also free them up to do what they do every day and all the rest of it. It would be bringing an extra asset in. The problem with that one is you'd have to show that that was actually worth it financially. It wasn't just another cost, because money is such a huge issue now.
But it's a huge.
What do you think? Do you think it actually pays for itself?
I personally believe that as well. But again, that isn't backed up on cost effectiveness analysis. Those are things in the NHS that, unfortunately, it might be obvious to me and you, but it needs to be shown on paper for this to be effective countrywide, because we're dealing with an organisation that spends over 100 billion per year. They can't be seen to be investing in fringe ideas that don't have the evidence base behind it, even though it's exceptionally obvious to a lot of us. But that's why I think it's going to take a grassroots approach, and that's why I think it's great that we have some other prominent medics in the media that are taking it upon themselves to talk about it and actually engage in the discussion. I'm sort of looking at it from another angle, where I'm just trying to get on with it, and I've licensed a course from America that is teaching their own medical students culinary medicine in New Orleans at the moment. It's actually been licensed to a fifth of all medical schools in America already, and this will be the first time it's coming to the UK. I've got to annotate it, obviously, for the UK market, and I'm basically going to just start teaching medical students and doctors essentially a free basis, the basics of cooking and the basics of nutrition as a starting point.
And so that's kind of voluntary on their part, because it's outside of their normal curriculum. They can do it out of interest to start with.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm going to try and accredit it by the Royal College, so that actually caters as CPD and hits some of the core competencies for general practitioners in particular. So I've looked through the curriculum, which is pretty extensive, and I've found, lifestyle promotion management, disease prevention, these are core competencies.
Right.
And if I can prove that this particular
course what you're
has
teaching.
That effect, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you were saying earlier on about it, actually, is the first thing is the lifestyle intervention before they go on to the other interventions.
Yeah, exactly.
Then, I mean, if you're not, they're not really teaching it. There's a gap in the market.
There
you need to get in
huge,
and say,
huge gap. Yeah.
I'll do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's going to take someone to champion this from the ground up, because, as we've seen over the last 10 years, the government, the Medical Schools Council, the GMC, they haven't changed the nutrition element of our medical school degree for years, and it still hasn't. I was really saddened to hear that they're not getting any more nutrition training at med schools today, right now, from those medical students last night. So.
Yeah, well, when you consider the rate at which the understanding is progressing on this front, it's like shocking, really.
Yeah.
You know, talk about lack of continuous professional development. It's got a few decades to catch up. Yeah. Okay, well, talk a little bit about relationships between doctors and the pharmaceutical industry. So most doctors think that the pharmaceutical industry has little to no influence on their prescribing habits, a bit of science, you know, study looking at it shows an extremely different picture. In fact, do you think that something fundamentally needs to change in the relationship between the pharmaceuticals and the medical profession as to what they're allowed to do in terms of interacting with them?
I think there's a greater recognition, actually, that pharmaceutical companies do have an uneasy relationship with doctors, at least amongst my colleagues anyway. There's some prominent medics who've written whole books on the subject. Ben Goldacre, he's written a whole range of books on the uneasy relationships between us and them. And I think that relationship has been pulled under scrutiny by, you know, the editor of the B&J, who are looking at more efficient ways and less controversial ways of displaying information that pharmaceuticals the studies that they come across and how they present in journals. It's a very uneasy relationship that we do have with them. We sort of need them, but it does need to be refined for sure.
I mean, the problem becomes that they've got a very different aim to the medical world, which is trying to help people to get better. They're trying to make money, so they're fundamentally trying to do different things. That's why I think it's an uneasy relationship, because if they were trying to make people well, they'd be all on the same page, wouldn't you? And so there wouldn't be a conflict. But there is actually a major sort of huge elephant in the room, conflict of interest, there. Which
I think you're right. You know, our goals aren't aligned in that respect, and we have to utilise each other with that understanding and that that recognition. And it's something in medical school, from my memory, that we weren't really taught that much about. And I think perhaps, I don't know, there might be an uneasy relationship within the medical schools. I mean, the university that I went to is very well known for its research capabilities. You can't be then seem to be, you know, taking money from pharmaceuticals or working in collaboration with them whilst also teaching your medical students, you know what, you need to be very wary of these guys.
I know. The thing is, there's such enormous amounts of money involved, and all the institutions are relying on them in some way, including charities. All being fed money by this huge pharmaceutical industry, they're all like, well, we mustn't say that, must we? I don't think it's like it's a relationship that shouldn't exist or something. There's nothing wrong with them having different endpoints, different aims, but it needs to be absolutely out in the open and therefore dealt with properly so that it doesn't actually stop the doctors doing what they're supposed to be doing.
No, I totally agree with that. And again, I think that's going to be a grassroots approach rather than something that we can allow medical schools to sort of educate their students on, because of that relationship that they have, because of the amounts of money that are involved. And a lot of these institutions rely on medics coming from medical schools, so they can help them with their own businesses.
Your colleague Dr. Chatterjee has been stirring it up a bit on the TV recently, which I love to see, but he's going around there taking people off drugs and making them well with lifestyle interventions. I mean, that's not what doctors are supposed to do, is it, really? And nonetheless, he's still quite unexpectedly, unfortunately, he's getting criticised for doing it, you know, fantastic work. But the fact he's even getting the airtime now is a kind of sign of the times. I think it's a very good thing that he can get on the TV doing that stuff at all. It's really amazing. So can you talk a bit more about how you anticipate your dream? You've already mentioned this training course and everything, your dream of getting all doctors trained in nutrition. How do you see it working into the system?
Yeah, I think it's great you mentioned Rangan, because what he's doing is phenomenal. And the fact, and what you picked up on there, is the fact that he's getting airtime is a sign that times are changing. Mm. The fact that commissioners are willing to do something, this is the BBC as well, it's a very by the book sort of organisation.
Well,
the fact that they're
quite a strong and sort of very conservative side, which bucks progress in things like medicine.
So, you know, the fact that he's actually being allowed to show just the effectiveness of lifestyle interventions, it's really, really encouraging. It ties in very, very well with what I'm trying to do. My vision is to have, because I'm food orientated, I truly believe what you choose to put on your plate is the most important health intervention that anyone can make. And that's something I always tell my patients. So what Rangam's doing is really tying in well with what I want to try and do, because my vision is to try and have a community kitchen associated, affiliated with every single general practice surgery up and down the country.
Wow.
And they act as community hubs. They teach you, obviously, the basics of nutrition. You get evidence-based information from them. It can be, it's a resource for new parents to learn how to feed their children, for the elderly vulnerable population that are usually nutritionally deficient because of the inability to buy the food themselves or cook the food themselves. And there can be more opportunities as well for people who are suffering chronic disease, for example, to collaborate with each other, you know, utilize their own experiences and cook for each other as well. I mean, it's just a fabulous way. I currently work at a community kitchen that isn't affiliated with a GP, but that experience is really like hype for me, and you know, really given me a vision that I can truly see in the next 10, 15 years. I hope to see anything. If I've got anything to do about it, I'm going to really try and push for it.
Wow, that's a great idea. It's a great idea. Yeah, if you put it on with the doctor's surgery, tying the two things together in a kind of irrevocable way that gets a message across. Food is about health.
Yes, exactly.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was thinking when you were talking then, you were talking about the elderly not being able to cook for themselves, but actually young people can't cook for themselves
these days. Yeah, literally,
so many people do not know how to cook anything.
Yeah, yeah,
you give them a carrot, they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Maybe if it's been washed and peeled and put in a little package, they could munch it, you know, with a hummus, you know, but it's scary, isn't it?
It is really scary.
How disconnected people have got from preparing food.
And I think, you know, that's really interesting, because I can imagine having classes dedicated for teenagers or young kids. You know, we did a class at the community kitchen I did called Made in Hackney, and it was Parents and Kids Day, so we got the kids to do a smoothie, and we got the parents to make like a bit of curry. The kids were like loving it, you know, messing around with the fruit and stuff, and tasting the fruit. You know, just having this sort of conversation around food is something that's so powerful. That experience will last throughout life, because I know personally for me, growing up in an Indian household, the smells, the aromas, the connection with food that I had growing up has something that's permeated through my whole life.
Right,
now,
you wouldn't grow out of it. Yeah,
no,
that's
the thing.
And I think that is a lot of the problem, is that too many kids just don't have that these days. You know, you've got both parents out working all hours in order to try and sustain a family, and so food takes a second place, basically.
Exactly.
Okay, that sounds great. So, you're fairly young, bear with me. I wanted to know, do you think there's a significant number of other young doctors out there who maybe they don't feel like sticking their head above the parapet the way you are, but if somebody's doing it, they'll be saying, they're saying, yeah, sounds good, I want to do this as well. Do you think that there's a kind of army of doctors?
It's probably like a herd mentality, and it's something that I definitely... It's certainly crossed my mind, and the reason why it took me a while to come out and launch the Doctor's Kitchen was because of that fear of backlash from my colleagues. I mean, I had the idea of doing what I'm doing right now, which is a YouTube channel showing patients literally how to create recipes. 4 or 5 years ago, when I was training as a general practitioner, but that fear of being seen as cavalier or fringe really prevented me from putting myself out
there. It's a big deal.
And it's a big deal. I mean, now I'm very comfortable talking about it because I know the evidence base. I'm very, very confident with how I present myself in front of senior colleagues that might be skeptical. But luckily, all I've had from colleagues is encouragement, both junior and senior.
Right.
And I think that is another sign of the tide changing as well. So, yeah.
Well, that's very exciting to hear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, I hope they come in flocks to your training course. And,
I think it's the start. You know, once you train the doctors, they start using these lifestyle interventions themselves. They're more likely to talk about it with their patients. They're more likely to have a relatable, engaging conversation with patients about food and medicine, if you've experienced it yourself. It's exactly why Rangan is doing what he's doing. He had an unfortunate experience with his own child that he's been open about, and I've had my own health issues, and I've had other colleagues that are going through their own health issues as well, and the reason why they're turning to lifestyle medicine is because A, it's effective, and B, it's another tool in our fight against disease, and it's something that needs to be embraced rather than feared, especially when it
it's
such a safe way of treating it.
How many doctors do you think are watching those shows on the TV?
I hope there's going to be that. There's millions of people watching it.
I know. Yeah, they're very popular. I think he does it really well. He comes across in a very non-dogmatic kind of, way, and he's just exploring things with people. It's very interesting. I think it's not only interesting to see the effect on the people's health, it's also to see the effect on their psychology when they take on making themselves well rather than being made well by somebody else.
Yeah.
You can imagine if you just get a pill and you're sort of all right afterwards, a sort of neutral situation. But actually being empowered to make yourself well actually changes the way you see life and see yourself.
Yeah, and I think what's good, and I hope what's going to happen in the second series, is that you see it's a process. It's not a quick fix. It's not. And I think that is what, going back to what we were talking about, is an educational change that needs to happen amongst patients. We really need to make patients understand that getting rid of disease, getting rid of conditions, preventing disease is not something that we just do overnight. It's a process. It takes time. It's something that we need to practice. And he's given me the scoop on some of the episode. Yeah, so I'm really excited.
It's going
to be good, be fantastic.
I'll be watching. I'll be watching. All right. So, I want to come around to cancer now, all right?
Okay,
this is a show about cancer, after all. So it's just one of a range of chronic diseases. You've got Alzheimer's, heart disease, diabetes, whatever you like. They're all on the increase, these things. And some would say, well, these actually all products of the same root. They're all the same problems that are just emerging in different forms of different people. So would you see that with this range of diseases which typically accumulate over the years, all of them, that lifestyle interventions are like a single approach, if you like? I know lifestyle intervention is a very complex thing in itself, but as a sort of philosophy, if you like, a way of approaching this kind of disease, do you think there is a kind of single approach there which can address all of these tendencies simultaneously?
Yeah, well, I mean, like you said, lifestyle approaches are very, very multifactorial. It's not a single intervention, which is why when I look back at my own condition, it wasn't just the one thing. It wasn't just because I started eating grass and vegetables. It wasn't just because I started meditating. It was a whole collection of different things. It was my mindset that changed. So, I think it's important to make people realize that it's a collection of different things that we introduce into patients' lives that can prevent things like cancer and other lifestyle-related issues. That's probably me.
So that view that all these sort of the big chronic diseases are linked to a certain foundation, which is around the choices people make for the way they live. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. Yeah. I would certainly agree, because you see a lot of similarities in how we can treat them using lifestyle interventions and how we can prevent these sorts of things from happening. And what we've done in modern medicine is pigeonhole them, put them in diagnosis categories, and treat them individually.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, me, because I'm a general practitioner, I see the irrationality of treating diseases in isolation.
Right.
So, you go see an endocrinologist for your thyroid problem, and you go and see your cardiologist for your heart disease, and you go and see, your cancer specialist for your bowel cancer. And there isn't a real link up apart from the GP, who only has 8 minutes to see you. So the whole way in which our healthcare model is fit is around these sort of pigeonholing things without really treating everything in a holistic, collaborative manner. So the beauty of lifestyle interventions is that it kind of rids you of those diagnoses and treats you as a person, makes it much more prescriptive, and essentially it's personalized medicine without the fancy chemistry and the genetic testing that you need to do. It literally is personalization, because we're giving you interventions that you instigate on your own, and it's relatable to you. And that applies to things like cancer as well. I mean, we see if we take the focus away from the individual diseases themselves, their individual conditions, and we focus on wellness, and this goes for things like weight as well, which is a very common issue, you realise that you can have drastic, drastic effects on everything. It's not just that one particular condition that you're trying to achieve. It's kind of like with me, my goal wasn't to rid myself of atrial fibrillation. It was just to live a healthier lifestyle. And as a result, my atrial fibrillation went away. So it's the same sort of concept that I try and get into people's heads, that if you focus on wellness, your body has the ability to self heal through multitude of processes. It's not just because I'm reducing your inflammation. It's not just because I'm increasing your fiber intake. It's not just because I'm detoxifying you using certain foods that we know can reduce environmental pollutants. It's because we're focused on you as a person, we're focused on wellness.
Well, I think that's really interesting. You talk about this way that we're carved up into bits, not only organs, but also diseases.
Yeah.
They're all dealt with separately, and there is an effect of this, of course. And we're not capitalizing on the overview of the person. Interestingly enough, this drive towards specialization, in many ways, it's more and more, it sidelined the role of a GP. You go, a GP sends you off to the specialist, But actually, this gives a whole new role for the GP, because he's the only person who might know you.
Yeah, and
have some feeling for who you are and what's wrong and everything. But, it could be a big new role, actually giving people holistic care,
And I think that's why a lot of GPs are really leading the movement in lifestyle medicine, because
you see
the patients, they're much more interested in functional medicine because they're facing burnout themselves. Before I started getting into this whole thing, I was really feeling like I was just being sidelined as a doctor with a glorified secretarial role, where I was just writing referrals, you go see that patient, all right, you want these medications.
Read on the computer what to do.
Exactly, and just go by the guidelines and stuff. And this is actually giving us a much more autonomy and much more impact as well. And it's something that the patients love as well. So, we're having a lot more relatable conversations by focusing on them as a person rather than, we'll just send you along this channel because that's what we're trained to do.
Well, that's actually very exciting. I have some German friends in this country, and they said if there's something wrong with their children, they get on a plane straight away and go back to Germany.
Oh, wow.
Why? Because to them, a GP is in between them and the person they want to see. And I have personal experience of that, of the GP standing in the way of diagnosis. So this is actually an exciting new role for GPs that makes much more sense of their role, because there's a specialism there which nobody else is doing.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Lifestyle medicine is not being done, let's face it. So this is something where GPs could step into maybe the most important role ever for keeping people healthy in our country.
Yeah, exactly.
So, very exciting.
We're very well placed because, like you said, we know the patients. We understand their... And we've been practicing a form of lifestyle medicine for years.
Yes.
GPs have had incredible roles in mitigating people's concerns, reassuring where needed, diagnosing obviously and putting them through the right pathways. We've had incredible roles, but what's happening now is that we're being further and further stretched, where that role has become more of a secretarial role, where we're just putting people into silos, like you said, and just putting them along pathways.
Yeah.
We're not having that relatable conversation more, so it's time to go back to that role where you went to see your GP and that was it, they sorted you out.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Yeah, great. All right, I like it. So hopefully you're going to be able to really inspire some GPs with this line. This is the future for GPs.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the course that I'm going to try and do, it's going to be over the next couple of months. I got a book deal with HarperCollins, so I'm going to be writing my first cookbook as well.
Yeah, great.
I'm talking about food and medicine and basically getting the conversation started around lifestyle medicine on a great underground front, alongside people like Rungan and other prominent medics in the media.
So
it's exciting.
Name of the book?
It's going to be called The Doctor's Kitchen.
Kitchen, very good. And when's it coming out?
January 2018.
Okay.
I'm really excited. That's what I'm writing at the moment.
Great. Anyway, so thinking about the way things are now with GPs, I think this is how it goes pretty much, is that the GP sends you off to a specialist, you get a diagnosis of cancer, and that's probably the last time the GP sees you until you're booted out as having been treated. That's pretty much how it goes, isn't it?
We'll see you during your treatment process.
All right, good.
So, I'll have patients that come prostate cancer is a very good example.
Okay, so these are long-term management kind of
ones. Long-term management.
Yeah.
But even those with colorectal cancer is undergoing active management, the GP is still your first point of call. You don't always go to specialists because A, they're really overstretched themselves.
Okay.
They only have 10, 15 minutes per patient as well. And B, it's far easier to see your GP who may be looking after your other conditions, who has to replenish your medication stocks, who you need to see to get another referral somewhere else. Mm. Or perhaps you decide to see someone privately and they've, you know, instigated a whole other treatment plan and we need to start, you know, we need to plug you into the system. So, yeah, they still do have very much a role.
Oh, good. I'm pleased about that. I think it sounds like it's got better. My memory of it was the other way.
Yeah.
Literally, the GP had no role.
Yeah.
You know, which,
yeah.
Considering what we've already said about how much they do actually know the patient, their circumstances,
yeah.
and all that kind of thing, that's a bit tragic. Isn't it? It's a huge loss, basically. Yeah.
It really depends on the type of management you're receiving as well. Depending on like how proactive your particular oncology team is, they might just want you to see them as well.
Mm.
Or they might plug you in to see a cancer specialist nurse, who will be your main point of contact between you and the oncology team. But still, depending on your relationship with your GP, mm. what your general practice is like, that will definitely have an impact. I know there are some surgeries that are pretty much exclusively run by locals or salary GPs.
Right.
So that whole concept of you going to
the
see the same GP
yeah.
is breaking down quite a bit, particularly
that's bad news, isn't it?
That's bad news. That's
yeah.
really bad news. Because
yeah.
you don't get continuity of care.
Yeah.
And I am actually, if I'm honest, part of that problem because I'm a locum at the moment. I choose to do a lot of my other work on the side, so I can't afford the time to consistently be at the same surgery all the time.
Two heads on. Right.
And yeah, and a lot of people are turning that because being a regular GP at the same surgery 5 days a week is terrible.
Stress.
It is so much stress. And a lot of my colleagues that are qualifying as GPs now are turning away from GP because of that reason. So the system needs to change for sure. But
how much, I mean, obviously there's a time issue with the stress, but how much of that stress do you think is a direct result of not having the capability to help people in a meaningful way, in the kind of ways we've been talking about, in a holistic way, and just doling out some pills and then seeing them 3 weeks later and doling out some more pills. You know, I feel, I imagine that's deeply unsatisfying in a certain kind of way, whereas actually changing somebody's life so as they actually are living better would be extremely rewarding. I mean, I can't imagine anything more rewarding for a health practitioner than that.
Yeah, totally. I think it's a multitude of things. So A, we're not trained, so we don't know the power of lifestyle intervention, the majority of us don't anyway, or the true power of it. I think everyone has a faint idea, it's like we were talking about, like, you know, a generally good diet, but the real impact of lifestyle change, I don't think a lot of people appreciate. And B, we don't have that healthcare model that's set up for that. And when I'm working, I'm seeing 40 patients a day. I have my prescriptions, I see people in their homes, and a telephone consult. The day is just so crammed. It's very, very hard to have that, you know, meaningful conversation with someone who needs it. I always run late. Since I've started doing more lifestyle, it's inevitable. You know, at the end of my surgery, people are waiting for an hour, hour and a half. And not every GP up and down the country can do that. And I know the partner, the GP practice that I work at, she is always there 13 hours a day, 5 days a week. I don't know how she does it. There's a lot of things that need to change.
Right. One of the things I was interested to hear from Rongan was that in order to try and combat that problem, he changed the way he delivered, in as much as he was grouping people together and saying, right, you guys have all got much the same problem. Come along on Thursday at 10 o'clock and I'll talk to the whole lot of you at once. And that kind of changing of the way we handle GP appointments makes sense, doesn't it?
Exactly, and I think that's an example of an innovative approach that you can do when you're at the same surgery. And B, that kind of mirrors quite nicely with what I'm trying to do with these community kitchens, where we teach people who might have the same disease or the same blood pressure issues or the fact they can't get it down with medication, and you just talk to each other about different ways in which they might have done it, do a walking group, cook some food that has been shown to improve blood pressure, make it culturally relevant, you know, all these different things. There's so many innovative strategies that we can use to improve people's lives holistically rather than in the bottom of the pill.
Well, it's interesting. One, you know, from where I sit, one of the biggest impetuses for change within the world of cancer is people informing each other about things.
Yeah.
And, you know, these huge social media groups where people are actually exchanging information. And, of course, getting people together to talk to them in the way you are, in a kitchen, or whether it's wrong and talking to a load of diabetics or whatever it is, you're not only delivering one-to-one, you're actually there. These people are making friends and they're actually supporting each other
in
dealing with their condition, because they're not doing it all on their own, which is so important, because of course it's lifestyle changes on your own is tough, isn't it?
100%. And I think loneliness and stress is something that's not really on many health professionals' agenda. It's changing for sure,
right?
But that is a huge cause of a lot of people's problems, is loneliness and our lack of community, particularly in places, in cities like London. And again, those sorts of hubs where you can see people, where you can meet other people who have the same condition, for example, is something that's so vitally important, but it's intangible. It's not something that we can put in a randomised controlled trial and show the cost effectiveness, but it does need to happen. And that, again, is another reason why, you know, it's another thing I'm going to write on my proposal is community kitchens up and down the country that will have as this beneficial side effect. In the realm of cancer as well, I can imagine having these community groups where people do have similar cancers and perhaps different cancers, and they learn from each other. I can so see that happening.
Great. Well, you know, I'm inspired by your vision for GPs, I must say. I mean, the thinking, of course, amongst people with cancer and people working in the field like myself is, come on, we want to get nutrition into the hospital, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, but you certainly need to get the hospital food sorted. But in terms of the nutritional education or the lifestyle education, it could be coming from the GP. It doesn't have to be coming from the hospital.
Oh, no.
And the GP is in many ways better placed to be the kind of family friend person who's looking after your lifestyle.
I think, you know, if we start a grassroots approach, we teach the medical students, we teach the GPs, that filters down into patients' minds. When they go to a hospital, they will be demanding this sort of thing, right? And it has to change. I mean, I've gone through the process. I thought, you know, a real innovative way that might get some PR and media movement is by creating my own doctor's kitchen cafe in a hospital setting. I looked into the contract of getting just a little store. They are worth millions of pounds, the NHS, and that's why whenever you go to a hospital, wherever you are up and down the country, you'll see the same three P's: WH Smith, Costa, M&S,
which is the biggest,
And then another one as well. But you know, and that's the way we can't change. We can't change things.
Corporations like that. Have got the whole.
Exactly.
Yeah. I agree. Well, I mean, that you must nevertheless pursue it.
Yeah.
Some hospital be forward enough thinking to say, well, we're going to make a space for this guy.
I hope so.
We really need that kind of thing. I mean, when you read about in America where they have like an organic garden attached to the hospital, it's like, please, you know,
that's just in America.
Unthinkable. You know, so
there's a place in Singapore apparently, and I don't know if it's a cancer specialist hospital, but they have a garden on their roof.
Yeah.
And their food comes from, a lot of their food comes from that garden on the roof, and it gives the patients. So, you know, not only does it provide them with great nutrition, it's educational as well for the patient.
Yeah.
They go to hospital, they figure out what to eat.
Yeah.
It will change. It's just going to take a few forward-thinking medics with a lot of passion and who are championing this idea.
Like you.
I was going to say Rungan, but
I think it's fantastic what you're doing. All right, well, look, I think we're going to wrap it up there. It's been brilliant to talk to you, Ruben. Thanks very much, and I wish you every success with your endeavours.
You know. Yeah, I really appreciate that.
Do take a look at Rupi's website and link up with him on social media. He's a man on a mission and he deserves our support. As usual, links to resources from today's show are on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk. click on Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and then choose UK Health Radio. An event coming up in the Yes to Life calendar is the Laughter Workshop. Sounds like fun. It's on the 22nd of April in Holborn in London. Look under Events on the Yes to Life website for more details. In next week's show, I'll be speaking about a recent Macmillan initiative to address the appalling lack of support after cancer treatment. I hope you'll join me again. Goodbye.